Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. Whether you know it or not, the English language is constantly growing and changing. New words emerge from technology, from popular culture, and from social phenomena. And every year, a carefully selected list of those new words are added to the dictionary. Joining us this morning to talk about the adventure of words is Mike Agnes, editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary. Mike, it's great to have you back again. Hello, Mike. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, now we can hear you. You and your staff have to constantly be alert to shifts in our language. Where do your word hunters spend most of their time looking for changes that can be incorporated actually into the dictionary?
I think the majority of our sources would be print. That is to say, not only books, novels, and nonfiction works, but periodicals, newspapers. We get some Canadian, some British sources so that we keep up with changes in their particular national varieties. And we have two readers who are dedicated to collecting these examples full time. We also monitor radio and television audio, and we get good pronunciation examples from those sources.
How do you keep track of all of that?
Well, we have a database. Everybody has a database, and ours resides on a computer in southern Ohio, actually mid-Ohio, and it's monitored and manipulated by an office that we have in Moscow, Russia.
You're kidding. All the way in Russia, we're monitoring the English language.
That's right. They maintain our databases, and it's from those databases. Not only do we get our research material, but we use similar databases on the same system for actually housing the dictionaries. We print from databases.
That's pretty amazing. You have a very, very elaborate system for doing this.
It's elaborate, but it's also all concentrated within one publishing company. So we have good control over that. We actually produce the print files that the printer uses to compose the dictionary. We don't farm anything out. We also do all our own proofreading.
When we talked last time, you told me afterwards that anybody can use the name Webster's. You talked about one big company. Is Webster's one big company?
No. Webster's is a name that any publishing company can choose to use if they're going to publish a dictionary. It's not copyrighted. It's not trademarked. Obviously, it refers to Noah Webster, who was one of the first great champions of American English in compiling dictionaries. But no one ever thought to say, claim that they had exclusive right to it. So it's a bit of a consumer nightmare. You will see the name Webster's used on dictionaries from many different publishing houses. What we've done is trademarked the three-word combination Webster's New World, and that identifies our flavor, if you will, of Webster's dictionaries.
So if you're using Webster's New World, that's a dictionary that goes, it traces its roots back to Noah Webster.
No, we don't. We have a different history. World Publishing in Cleveland, Ohio was a major publisher before World War II. And before war broke out, it was decided that they should do a completely new line of dictionaries according to new editorial principles. And after the war was finished and the editors who had gone to serve were able to get back, the first Webster's New World Dictionary in that mold was produced in two volumes in 1951. And 2 years later, the first college single-volume dictionary was published.
Okay. And so it's continued from that time till yet.
Yes.
How do you incorporate the digital age in your work? How do you put dictionaries out there, say, in online form or in other forms besides in print?
Well, that's very easy. If the core of your compiling is in computerized database form, instead of telling the computer system, spit this out and compose a page for printing, you simply say, change this to HTML and give us the file, and we'll post it on the web. Or we can license it out to people who are very adept at doing that and let them post it on the web.
Okay. And what additional features do you include?
We don't include additional features. We could, but as of now, the people who are licensing our college database and putting them on the web choose just to mimic the print form. I'll give you an example. There are fields in the database that say this word belongs to the realm of physics in some way, or belongs to the realm of, let's say, fishing or literature. But that doesn't print. But that is a way of we can search our database and databases internally, and a way that we can assign certain word entries to certain editors who are responsible for that category of entry. So that doesn't print, but it is available in the database if a licensee chooses to use it.
Oh, so they would just simply have to request it?
They would have to figure out a way to extract it, yes.
Okay.
You could do a search on it.
Okay. Well, we mentioned that you're constantly adding new words to the dictionary.
That's right.
You have an interesting group that's being considered for 2010. Let's talk about some of those.
Well, which one strikes you as unexpected?
Honking.
Honking. Okay. This the fisherman says, you won't believe the big honking trout I caught this morning. Right?
Right.
Right. And, of course, the trout was largely silent throughout the catch, but it was not honking. And a companion word is stonking, S-T-O-N-K-I-N-G. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard these.
Uh-huh.
They arose in the 1980s, and they had a very quiet initial life. They seemed to be very restricted to college students, and it seemed like it would be ephemeral slang and that it would slip into oblivion. But in fact, it stayed the course. So we're going to take the opportunity to add both of those, if not next year, then shortly thereafter.
And for those who have not heard these before, they are both adjectives.
That's right. They're intensifiers.
Okay. And that means it whatever it's modifying becomes bigger, grander.
That's right.
Larger,
mm-hmm.
More impressive.
Exactly. Hey, you've got a job waiting for you up here in Cleveland. This is wonderful.
Oh, hey, that may be my next career. You never know. Let's take another couple of these. MRSA is going to be included in the dictionary.
Yes, and I would predict that one is going to be very necessary. I mean, I will push to have that one in next spring. It's a all capital abbreviation, MRSA, pronounced MRSA, you're right. The breakout for it is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This is a staph infection, typically through the skin and resistant to the standard drugs used to fight staph. It's a very serious and infectious problem. Currently, I'm sure some of your readers have read articles in the newspapers about it,
mm-hmm.
And any drug-resistant illness is of great concern.
And this is the type of infection that I think I've read about this breaking out in, say, locker rooms?
Exactly. And so gyms and sports teams and so forth are looking for ways to minimize that. It's in some way contagious. If you have it, and you're sitting around on a workout bench, maybe doctors think maybe there should be some sort of way to make sure that the next person sitting on that bench does not contract it.
Mm-hmm. And I know many organizations, including professional football teams and so on, have taken some really, really serious measures to try to prevent MRSA.
Yes.
And prevent the spread. Let's talk about cloud.
Cloud. You know, I was talking with one of our citation readers, and we're always looking forward to the challenge late in the year to pick a word of the year for promotional and publicity purposes. Cloud is a logical candidate for that because it is, many say, the next generation of internet and computer activity. Cloud refers to the environment and the process of having the programs you use and the documents and spreadsheets that you produce reside on the internet, and you manipulate them, create them by connecting to the internet and to the particular directory where your work is located. In other words, on your computer, you wouldn't have to have Microsoft Office or your word processor. You use the one that's on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Google runs that. Microsoft has recently announced within the last 2 weeks that they are going to enter the fray there. And this is why netbooks, which is not on the list, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why netbooks are becoming so popular, because they are designed primarily to work off the web. They can be made smaller with smaller hard drives. They don't have to have all the application programs that most people have on their computers.
And just explain, what is netbook, Mike?
A netbook is a very small laptop with stripped-down features that is primarily designed to work off the World Wide Web and to use cloud computing, which is using applications that are already on the web, not on your personal computer, and storing your documents there, and, of course, also for blogging and other activities.
You have another word on here that I've heard before, and it's one that our business listeners are probably familiar with, deliverable.
Deliverable, yes, sort of office jargon. It is a project or a document or a report that has a specific due date for delivery to one's manager. And often at the end of the year, after your personal evaluation, your manager will give you your goals for the coming year, and that will include a list of deliverables. For example, we want the Johnson Project proposal done in the first quarter. So your report becomes a deliverable, something that you are expected to deliver by a certain time.
Okay. And a couple of others that you have here that I thought were kind of interesting, bar back and bartend.
Yes. There are many older speakers who would only use the verb tend bar. What does your son do for money in the summer? Well, he tends bar.
Mm-hmm.
But his one son is very likely to say, oh, I bartend.
So it's really just, how would you describe that process? Because it comes from tending bar.
Well, it comes from tending bar, but historically it may well have come from bartender. And that would be a back formation. You take bartender and you create a word that logically would have given birth to bartender as an extension, but in fact has never existed. So it's making up a parent word that hasn't existed up until now.
And in this case, you take a noun, bartender, and turn it into a verb, bartend.
Yes, that's right. If you turn a noun into a verb without changing the form, then that's called a functional shift. For example, we have this alarm here. It's designed to give extra security to the building. Let's equip the building with this alarm. Let's alarm the building.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you'll see signs that say, caution, this building is alarmed.
Which some people would see as a joke.
That's right. People who resist change in language seem particularly sensitive about functional shifts. They will simply pound their fist on the table and say, that is a verb. It's always been a verb. There's no noun for it. Stop this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that's one of the ways that language grows.
And that's always been the case.
I think so, yes. It's not such a bad thing, but it's the change from one system or protocol of language to something new that has typically been invented by a younger generation of speakers, and it seems to bother people over 50 quite a bit. But
uh-huh.
That's a natural reaction, and as someone well over 50, I have that reaction too. But if I look back in time, I can name words that I objected to when they first showed up on the radar, and yet have generally, over the years, I've adopted them and found them to be functional and very nice to have.
You know, Mike, it's really interesting. I've wondered a lot of times, where do these words come from in the first place?
Well, somebody had to invent them. Somebody creative, or perhaps making an error, had to come forth with a new form or a new pronunciation, and it simply caught on. Or there are a collection of people who do it independently for the same reason. For example, looking at a word that they've never heard pronounced, guessing at the pronunciation based on other words of similar form, and in fact, it's not right. So it can be an individual person. Let's take Dante Rossetti. In the 1800s, he was translating medieval French, a ballad by François Villon, and came across the French noun entant, A-N-T-A-N. There is no exact equivalent in English. So he said, well, listen, I'm a poet. I've got to solve this somehow. We have all sorts of words in English of that time that began with yester. There was yesterday. There was yestermorn, yestereve, et cetera, et cetera. There was no yesteryear, however. And he thought, well, people will understand it. It has a nice ring to it. It fits the meter. So we have the very memorable phrase, where are the snows of yesteryear? In the mid-1800s. And a good question for your audience would be, can you pinpoint the first time you heard that word yesteryear? I can, and when we get into discussion, we'll see if I learned the word the same route that your listeners did.
And that's a good time to remind our listeners, we welcome you to join the conversation. You just have to give us a call at 292-8513 or email openline at wosu.org. We're, of course, talking to Mike Agnes, editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary, and maybe you can remember things like when you first encountered the word yesteryear, or maybe a word has come out that you've heard and it just didn't work for you. It just grated on you when you heard it. Or maybe there was a word that you've heard that you just took to immediately. Give us a call and let us know, 292-8513, or email openline at wosu.org. One of the words on your list of words that are probably going to be in the dictionary next year, Mike, is one that kind of caught my attention, re-gift.
I was going to guess that was the one.
Yeah, it just seems like such a practical way to express what you're doing.
Yes, it's very handy. It's short. You would expect that there would be a verb for this practice. Someone gives you a gift. You choose not to use it, but you turn around and send it to a third party as a gift. It's very convenient, but it sounds odd the first time. It's still a word I do not use. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I'll start using it before I die. I can't predict it.
You're going to be resisting this word. It's hard for me to imagine the editor-in-chief of a dictionary being resistant to new words.
Well, I'm the same I have the same experience with language as everybody else who speaks English, and I'm human. As an editor, I have to make sure that my particular preferences do not creep into the dictionary. The dictionary is supposed to be reporting facts. If people are using regift, it deserves to go in, and along with pre-order, which to me is the strangest thing in the world. If you order something that isn't yet in stock, you are still ordering it. It's just that there is going to be a delay in its delivery. But pre-order now means we can't ship it right away, but you can put your order into the queue or into the line. And when we get to your order, we will process it, provided we have stock on hand. I resist that one, too. But it has every right to be in a dictionary because it is used by people.
Yeah, it's out there and it's in use.
That's right.
Well, we have some callers on the line. Let's take some calls now, Mike.
Okay.
This one is from Wes. Hi, Wes. You're on Open Line. You have a question or a comment about words in your life?
Yes. As an avid Scrabble player, I'm always looking for a trap word. So I'm wondering if there are any words that I can anticipate coming online or within the dictionary that with which I can trap an opponent.
Okay. Well, you usually have a reference book as a judge, a particular dictionary that you all use. But here's a trap word, because we don't – well – K-U-D-O.
K-U-D-O.
Yes.
With no S on the end.
That's right. With no S at the end. Very good, Charlene. Kudos or kudos is a noun meaning praise. This author garnered much kudos from the critics with his first novel. However, some people have looked at that in print, figured that the S was a plural, so there must be one kudo out there.
Gokudo.
I think older and careful speakers and writers still see this as an error. It obviously was an error in interpretation, but it was an error committed independently by a lot of people, and it's been around since before World War II.
A bit like ordering a single grit for
yes,
breakfast.
Exactly.
One grit. That's a good one, Wes.
And yeah, I must say that in the history of English, this misinterpretation of a word that is singular but happens to add end in an S is common. That is where we got the word P-E-A, as a countdown singular. It was P-E-A-S-E, as in peas porridge hot.
Huh, that's an interesting fact.
So nobody objects to P, P-E-A. If it hangs around long enough, it makes sense for the next coming generation of speakers, and they won't turn a hair. They'll use it.
Okay. All right, I remember K-O-D-O.
K-U-D-O.
K-U-D-O.
Right.
Good luck with your Scrabble, Wes. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
This call is from Britt. Hi, Britt. You're on Open Line.
Good morning. As a space buff, seeing this being the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11, I actually have a word that I heard only on Apollo 13 mission where they had the problem, Houston, we had a problem thing.
Yes, right.
The word consumables. And to me, it was like they were taking inventory of all the things that they had that they were losing, like air. and that was a consumable. Now, where have you seen that? Is that in the dictionary? And is that I see that kind of as an inventory application.
Yes. In business, I think you could find some usage for it. We have it only as an adjective, which suggests a consumable good, but I'm sure that we can find business examples of its use. And in fact, I will pass that on to the readers to put on their watch list.
Great.
All right.
Thank you for the tip.
I have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
The word pre-owned, is that just an elite form of used?
Creole, C-R-E-O-L-E?
No, pre-owned.
The word we were talking about earlier.
That's a fancy elite word of used, right?
Yeah, elite euphemism. They're trying to put a nice shine on it that I don't like to buy a used car, but a pre-owned car would be just fine.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, Britt. Thanks for your call. This one is from Pat. Hi, Pat. You're on Open Line. You have a question or a comment?
Yes. Good morning. Back in the day, to coin a phrase, when I was an undergraduate many decades ago, I took a class where we had to do some exploring in the OED, and it seems to me that that was the class in which there was presented like a conflict between what was a prescriptive dictionary as opposed to a descriptive.
Yes.
And I wondered what the mission statement, or maybe that's not where it is, but how your dictionary approaches that that dilemma, if it is one.
It is. It's simply a matter of what you as an editorial team are capable of doing and defending. Prescriptive describes an editorial style that I refer to as a schoolmarm style. In other words, do this and don't do that. I don't think we can set ourselves up as that sort of authority. For every word that I would caution people not to use, there is an excellent author on record who has used it for effect. So you cannot give a broad no-no note to a word. You can say something like objected to by some, and we do use that. The only thing we can do is describe. We can describe what is going on in the language community based on material evidence that substantiate our decisions, and if necessary, be descriptive to the point of showing that it's a controversial word or showing that it's has a certain register, slang, informal. Informal means you're not likely to use this in speaking with the president over dinner. Mm-hmm. Slang is it's colorful words that are not standard, but are used widely for effect. So you can describe in that way, but it's up to the individual speakers to decide if they want to adopt a word and use it. I always say it's a very roomy sandbox, and there's room enough for us all to play in the English language. And I'll let you speak and write as you see fit, and I will turn around and describe the language that you use.
Pat, we thank you for your call. We're going to have to take a little break right now. We're talking to Mike Agnes, editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary. We'll continue our conversation after the break, and if you'd like to join in, please give us a call at 292-8513 or email openline at wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from OSU's Department of Psychiatry, currently recruiting children and adolescents with ADHD for clinical research studies. More at medicine.osu.edu/psychiatry or 293-7109.
You're listening to Open Line on WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich today. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Coming up today at 1 on Point, California was the Golden West. The model, the dream. Now, according to The Economist magazine, Texas is on top. What does that mean for the country? Well, find out today at 1 here on WOSU 820. Should be a beautiful July day today, partly cloudy with a high of 87. Currently it's 78 degrees. Low tonight around 65. Scattered thunderstorms rolling in tomorrow, but that should cool us down a bit, high of 78, and expect a beautiful weekend, both Saturday and Sunday. Partly cloudy and highs in the mid-70s.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard.
More than 31,000 AEP customers around Columbus have lost power since June 20th. They've had 14 break-ins to substations in the last 2 weeks.
That's really high. That's hitting multiple stations a night.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Welcome back to Open Line. We're talking to Mike Agnes, editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary, about innovations in language, changes in language. Maybe you have a favorite word that is a new one that you've started using. Maybe there's one that just grates on you every time you hear it. If so, give us a call. Share your word story at 292-8513 or send an email to openline at wosu.org. And Mike, just a few minutes ago, we were talking about words that are annoying, that are new ones. And we have an email from Michelle who says, I am in my mid-20s, and one word I cannot tolerate is conversate. It is a word that I hear multiple times a day, and I always bite my tongue. I can converse with someone, and I can also have a conversation, but I have not once found an occasion to conversate. Do you conversate, Mike?
No.
Does the dictionary include conversate?
No, we don't. I know we have examples in the database, but not sufficient to indicate that we have to report this yet. We have three criteria in selecting a new entry. One is breadth of use, frequency of use is number two, and three is whether or not it's restricted to such a narrow group of speakers that even though it's high frequency with them, that the average person is unlikely to run across it. So if it's a word that's used only in the Ohio State University Journal of Arthroscopic Surgery, even if it's used 100 times a year, it's not going to make it into the dictionary.
Okay, so that word could be just such a...
That's
confined to such a small group of people.
It just doesn't seem to be widespread enough. Now, your listener who emailed in is in a particular conversational environment for some reason where it is widely used. Maybe it's dialectal. Maybe it reduces in frequency if you travel, let's say, four or five states away. I've heard it, but I cannot say I hear it every week. I don't even hear it every month.
You know, a lot of words like that show up in things like movies.
Yes, sometimes they do, although generally the dialogue written for movies is read by so many people. There is going to be a consensus among several people who are fiddling with the dialogue that that yes, people will understand this. Yes, people will have a certain reaction to it. Yes, it helps to define that this particular character.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, movie dialogue has some wonderful examples of English.
And that, it seems like it would be one of the principal ways for propagating word
yes,
usage.
You're right. If it's a sympathetic character, you might, without realizing it, say, oh, I'll adopt that. He was a nifty sort of person, and I know how to use that,
mm-hmm.
even without consciously thinking it.
Or it sounds so good, it just catches on. Everybody starts using it because they've heard it on their favorite TV show or
sure.
in one of their favorite movies. And
I'm
the
sure.
character is one that's so popular, people wind up imitating the way that character speaks.
That's right. And in fact, that's not so unusual because we do that with famous lines of dialogue, such as, we'll always have Paris, or do you feel lucky? Well, do you? Or
mm-hmm.
the ever-popular and changeable, we don't need no stinking badges.
Ah, yes.
Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Oh, don't get us started. We'll have a whole slew of movie lines coming in, Mike. Let's take a call now. This one's from Frank. Hi, Frank. You're on Open Line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on yesteryear and tell you my early hearing of that word when I was a child. This would have been the 60s. Center of Science and Industry here in Columbus had Street of Yesteryear.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a recreation of historical street, and the kind of interesting thing was that the beginning of it was like a mid-19th century street with, kinds of stores. They would general store and blacksmith they'd have there, and as you walked along it, it progressed through history up until, say, the 1920s. It was a Nickelodeon movie theater where you could watch old silent movies, and so that's where I first heard the word yesteryear. They, I don't know if probably existed before that, but
it's interesting, Frank. It's interesting that you can place exactly when you first encountered that word.
Well, as far as I know, I was pretty young, maybe 5 or 6 or 7. Well,
that would be it.
Yeah,
For you at least, and Charlene is right. I find it fascinating that you can think, well, that was exactly the first time I heard that word, or I know that my mother taught me that word, or my father taught me that word. With others, people are a little bit vague. A previous caller used the phrase "back in the day,"
mm-hmm.
and I swear that 15 years ago, I had never ever heard that expression.
Yeah.
And now it's everywhere.
Or old school.
My first encounter with yesteryear predates yours by about 10 years.
Oh.
So we'll see if anybody remembers it from the mid-50s.
Right. I didn't think that was probably the first use, but at least that was my first exposure, you know, kind of culturally limited to watching Leave it to Beaver and Batman.
Well, you remembered... You remembered yesteryear from that encounter, and that's great.
Right. Well, that was an actual title printed up on the wall saying that's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
I had another question about, I don't know if you call them compound words, where, for instance, you put the word un, like unrelenting,
right.
or words. And I'm curious about ones that the base word doesn't exist. For instance, uncouth.
Yes.
Uncouth, but
yes.
I don't think couth is a word.
You'd have to go back and... to the largest dictionary you can find, and that would probably be the Oxford English Dictionary in 20 volumes, and trace the etymology. It's very possible that there used to be a word, couth, but it's not used anymore. And or check a dictionary to see if at uncouth they give an explanation for how it came to be. But there are some anomalies like that where the pairing of the base form and the extended form with un doesn't exist. It's a fascinating thing, but almost anything can happen. And in fact, our etymology shows that in Old English, there was a word, couth, C-U-T-H, which was the past participle of a verb, which meant to know, therefore not knowing what's proper, for example.
Okay.
So, in fact, that conjectured mechanism is exactly what it turns out to be.
Well, Frank, we certainly appreciate you sharing your story and giving us some food for thought by bringing up the word uncouth and words like it. Let's take another call now. This one is from Marwan. Hi, I hope I pronounced your name right, Marwan.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, of the words that are initially, identified for consideration, what percentage of them generally, make it every year, and what percentage don't?
Well, we probably, in the database, I know that we have several thousand words that haven't made it into the dictionary. Perhaps we only have two citations or three citations for them, and we can't even start to consider them unless we have far more examples. So the percentage, if you include everything, has got to be under 5%.
That actually makes it in.
That's right.
Oh, okay. And then another question I had is grammar. I don't think I'm sure somebody does something similar for grammar, or does your organization do that as well?
Well, we don't have any specific titles or books devoted to grammar. Sometimes a dictionary entry does ask for some grammar identification. For instance, usually in the plural, or often construed as a singular noun instead of a plural, or something of that sort. Or a word will almost always be used in conjunction with another word. But that's not really grammar. We don't talk about the subjunctive. And by the way, the subjunctive is still alive and well in American English. We don't talk about sequence of tenses. That's for a different sort of book.
Okay. Thank you.
Marwan, thanks for your call. This one is from Larry now. Hi, Larry. You're on Open Line. You have a question or a comment for us?
Yeah, I'd like to just hazard a guess and say that, Mike, your first encounter with the word yesteryear was during the introduction to the program, The Lone Ranger.
You hit it right on the nose. The voiceover, that was a black and white series. The voiceover ran something like this. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats. Etc.
Was it radio or TV that was your...
Well, it may have been both, because when I first encountered it, it was shortly after we'd bought our first TV in 1955, and it's very possible I also heard it on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
All right, then. Thanks so much for making such a good guess, Larry. Thanks for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye. This one is from Jerry. Hi, Jerry. You're on Open Line. You have a question or a comment?
Comment, and I'm one caller late. I remember those thrilling days of yesteryear, and I was going to bring that up, but Larry beat me to it. So he must be older than I am. I don't know.
Or he dials faster than you do.
So anyway, yeah, that was it, and the thrilling days of yesteryear. And I remember it. I don't remember it on radio. I'm 60, so I remember it 55, 56 on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And... didn't think that much about it other than the fact that I thought it was a pretty good word.
That's right. It was nifty, but you didn't realize that it in any way was unusual. It was just, boy, there's another one I got to remember.
It made sense.
It made sense, and it was also a bit, dare I say it, literary?
A bit?
Yeah.
And I think if the Lone Ranger would have used it, Tonto would have said, that right, Kim Wasabi.
Jerry, thanks so much for
your
call.
Thank you. Good show.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
We have you really started something with this yesteryear, didn't you, Mike?
Well, apparently. It's a good example of what can happen in language and what can happen psychologically with one's own language.
Absolutely. We're talking to Mike Agnes, who is editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary, about language and new words, old words that maybe you still like, new words that maybe you don't like. If you have some favorite words or a question about words, give us a call at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. And we do have an email from Miles, who says, one outdated word that I never avoid using is druthers, as in if I had my druthers, meaning if I got what I want. A new one I like is chillax, which is a merger of chill out and relax. How much more laid back can you get, Miles says.
I've personally not run across that, but our readers may have here in the office. Chillax, and I wonder if, you know, what I would, obviously we often go to Google and to the web to find examples that that we've missed or that will help clarify the meaning of a particular word we're examining. That sounds like a word that one might find in a blog, for example, where people are trying to express themselves with their own particular idiolect. And don't misconstrue that word. That doesn't mean an idiot's dialect. It means personal, the personal language that you alone master and use. That sounds like a good word for a blog, and I will have to go take a look and see it. And it's a logical formation. And I would never want to reject druthers either. It's a wonderful word.
And our resident word expert, Emma, says chillax was very popular in the 90s.
Uh-huh. I missed it somehow. That was before blogging.
Clearly, this one did not make it to the dictionary, did it, Mike?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay, let's take another call. This one is from Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on Open Line.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Agnes a word, or perhaps it's words, that Bob Costas used at the Summer Olympics. And I was so fascinated by the word, I didn't hear the context in which he used it.
Mm-hmm.
Sui genuis or sui genius?
Okay, that's a Latin phrase.
All right.
Two words.
Two words. Okay.
Sui is the first.
Mm-hmm.
Generis. Generis.
Oh, E-R.
Uh-huh. Okay. And that comes from the same root that gives us genus or generic.
Mm-hmm.
It means individual and unduplicated.
Okay.
And it will be an entry in most dictionaries, and I'll call up ours. And it means without a counterpart or equal, unique.
He must have been talking about Michael Phelps.
Yes, I suppose you could construe a sentence where that would be a good expression to use.
Thank you so much. I've looked and couldn't find it. So.
It's often tough if this is Latin. I mean, we don't even teach Latin in schools anymore.
Yeah.
And that's too bad. I think Latin adds a lot to your understanding of the English language.
It does, and it also gives you an understanding of how alternate ways that languages can operate. And if you've had a couple of years of Latin, you will take to other foreign languages without being mystified. You'll know that there are other mechanisms at work that, for instance, this always surprises people learning French or German. They assign masculine or feminine status to inanimate nouns.
That's true.
That's true, and we don't do that in English.
Okay.
So when you learn a noun in Latin or German, French or German, you have to remember if it's a masculine or feminine noun.
And, Joe, we have to thank you for giving us a Latin addition to our vocabulary today. And we have another call now from, this one is from Jerry. Hi, Jerry, you're on Open Line.
Several years ago, I heard about a discussion in an newspaper editorial room about a sentence, and the editors themselves did not agree as to how to write this. The sentence is, there are three twos in the English language. And I was wondering how an editor might handle that sentence.
Oh, that's a really good question.
Well, you recast it, because if you're going to, there are three twos, naturally you don't know how to spell it, because you can't. You can't choose one of the three spellings for a word pronounced as two. for that particular case. It sounds like you ought to be able to do it, but that sentence has to be recast. There are three words pronounced T-O-O, rhymes with W-H-O in the English language. You're going to have to do it some way like that.
Oh, okay.
There's no trick way out of it.
Okay.
All right. Good question, Jerry. Thank you. We have an email now from Luke who says, recently the word staycation was added to a dictionary. Are there any other new words that made it into the dictionary because of the down economy?
No, not yet. And remember, the down economy has been around for less than 2 years, if you count the months. And usually we wait for 3 years following our first register of a new word before we consider it. It has to have been around for, it has to have a track record. So far, we're collecting new words. And we have older words for economy troubles like stagflation. But nothing that new comes in. And the reason is, once we put in the word, we don't want to take it out if it fails. So it's got to have at least three, unless, with rare exception, it should be around for a minimum of 3 years.
Okay. Let's talk to Steve now. Hi, Steve. You're on Open Line. You have a question or a comment for Mike?
Yes. Good morning. I'm interested in understanding how the number 209 gets pronounced 209 rather than 209. There's a lot of examples where people will use the word O instead of zero. How does
yes.
that come about? Is it just difficult to enunciate the word zero?
It's not difficult, but O is easier. There's less energy expended. It's conceivable that the practice was originally a joke, but in fact, you're just you're using O because you have the orthography in mind. If we didn't have writing, no one would think to call it 209, unless they want to truncate the word zero into O.
Yeah,
but it's the form of the numeric presentation on paper that suggests that this is a shortcut.
Yes, it's like in baseball, the count would be 2-0.
Two and O. And so there's an idiom where
2-0 sounds odd.
Right, and in baseball, that is the only form. Yes, nobody would say 2-0.
Yes, but this is just something we have to learn to accept. It just annoys me a little. It's just something that we have to learn to accept.
Well, you are allowed outside of baseball to say 2009 or 209 for the number, for your street address. That's fine. Nobody's going to object to that.
Sure.
And
okay.
as long as we are on the subject of baseball, may I give a plug, Charlie?
Sure.
I just went to, 2 weeks ago, the Cleveland Public Library to get a copy of the Dixon Baseball Dictionary, third edition. And I have to say that this is, if you like baseball, you have to go to the library and take a look at this, and it's very likely you'll want a copy yourself. It's just a marvelous one-man effort. And the name Dixon is spelled D-I-C-K-S-O-N, Dixon Baseball Dictionary, and again, it's the third edition. It is fantastic. Take a look at it if you are a sports language fan or a baseball fan.
I think probably all of the baseball fans in the building here at WOSU are probably taking note.
Okay. It is a big book. It runs over 900 pages. It's thorough. Oh. It has such odd terms as the tools of ignorance and phrases that live in the memory of baseball fans everywhere, such as "Say it ain't so, Joe." It's a marvelous browsable dictionary.
Oh, it sounds like it would be interesting reading, even if you're not necessarily so much of a baseball fan. If you just enjoy words and phrases and where they came from,
right? And he gives examples well back into the 1800s of people who used a particular term that he's talking about. It's very browsable and. It's a wonderful work.
All right. Let's take another call. This one is from Michael. Hello, Michael?
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Just fine.
Good. I tell you, I heard a word in a book I'm reading by C.F. Forster, Beat to Quarters, and they're describing a woman who's never been married, and she's in her late 20s, and the word that they're using is unsexed. And it sounds really chauvinistic, but I've just never heard that term, and I just wondered if you knew anything about that particular word.
You know, I don't.
It's used more than once in describing this woman, and obviously British terminology, but unsexed. And it sounds terrible, but that's how they're describing this woman.
Well, in literary terms, usually I see that as the removing of sexual or gender qualities from someone.
Okay.
We have unsex as a verb, and
uh-huh.
Definition two is to deprive of the qualities considered characteristic of one's sex, especially to make unwomanly. So I think they're probably using this as you describe it as an adjective. It is probably technically a participle in that in that sense. In other words, it would be expected in that society in that time that a woman would have been married by then.
Okay.
So
very good.
Without that social status, the speakers are taking away part of her gender identity.
Okay. I'd never heard that word before, obviously, and it sounded very negative, but mm-hmm. Now that you mention that, they went on to say that she did not have horse-like features of some British women that would make her undesirable, so they could not understand why she was unsexed.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You've got a great show, and getting back to Latin, my daughter went to Catholic high school and took 4 years of Latin, and I tell you what, it helped her tremendously when she went to college.
I don't doubt it.
I bet it did.
It really did, and you know, she studied two languages, that being German as well as French, when she went to Audubon University and Audubon College, I should say. But it really did help tremendously.
Okay, Michael, thank you so much for sharing that.
My pleasure, and a great show, and have
thank
a good
you.
Day.
All right, you too. We have time to get in. No, let's take one more call here. This is Mary. Hi, Mary. Oh. You're on Open Line.
Thank you. I have heard in recent years the term affluent, and I was raised with that term affluent, meaning someone who had wealth or money. But lately I've heard it pronounced affluent,
mm-hmm.
and it reminds me of the word effluent.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Something entirely different. And I want to know, I haven't looked it up, I have to confess, but I really like the word affluent
mm-hmm.
in that particular pronunciation.
Well, that's fine. And in fact, affluent is much less frequently encountered, according to our records. But you will find it, and that's probably what we would describe as a spelling pronunciation. People
mm-hmm.
see the word before they hear it, and they guess that that is going to be pronounced as affluent, and they
mm-hmm.
go forth and use that. We're all guilty of making that mistake at times.
Mm-hmm.
But I think affluent, with the stress on the first syllable, is predominantly used.
Okay.
And effluent only has that one. not true. Effluent is pronounced with with one pronunciation on the first syllable.
And mm-hmm. what is the meaning of effluent?
Effluent,
Mike?
Is a thing that flows out or
like
forth
quick.
Or something.
Mm-hmm.
or it's the output, the effluent of a sewer or a septic tank.
Okay, very good. All right, Mary, thank you for
thank you.
Helping us improve our vocabulary.
Thanks so much, Charlie.
All right. And we have time for just one more really, really quick one. Jason will be our last questioner. Jason, you've got 30 seconds.
What about the word and or?
And or is typically written with a slash in between, a horizontal slash bending to the right, what we call a forward slash, and there is no space on either side. So it is a compound word, if you will, and it's perhaps unique.
All right, very good. And we stayed within our time limits, too. Jason, thank you for your question. Mike, it's always a pleasure talking to you. It's amazing all the things we can discover once we start talking about the dictionary.
Well, that's part of it is because you have such a wonderful listening audience.
Oh, we do. We do. And they have amazing vocabularies, too. We'll get you back on Open Line another day so that we can continue our discussion. We apologize to everyone whose emails and calls we did not get to, but we certainly appreciate all of you participating. participating. And Mike, thank you especially. Mike Agnes is editor-in-chief of Webster's New World College Dictionary, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Charlene.
All right. This is Open Line on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.